Hiya, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and this podcast is recorded in the lands of the Whadjuk people of Boorloo, Perth. Sovereignty never ceded. Filmmaker Robert McCowan is an independent filmmaker who continues to stun with a body of work that is emotionally shocking and at times darkly comedic. His previous film, The Killing of Two Lovers, stands as one of the towering achievements of modern American indie filmmaking. And it's with that strength and the fortitude of low-budget filmmaking that he turns the story of a young man trying to do the right thing for his family into a darkly comedic tragedy with the integrity of Joseph Chambers. Robert collaborates once more with Clayne Crawford, with Clayne playing the titular character. Joseph here is a skewed version of David from The Killing of Two Lovers. They're both dedicated to their families and their safety, yet, unlike David, Joseph is filled with a pride and misguided machismo that he believes will be enough to support his family in the event that there is some kind of massive event where food or supplies are no longer widely available. Yet, while on the surface this may seem to narratively be a COVID-adjacent film, the integrity of Joseph Chambers instead explores the meaning of masculinity in America. And just like Two Lovers, it shows a nation on the precipice of violence. Here, the violence is not delivered with purpose. Instead, it's a mishap, a soul-breaking act of accidental mayhem. Integrity sits on the shoulders of Clayne, but it's buoyed by two performances that bookmark the film. At its opening, Jordana Brewster, as Joseph's wife, Tess, is given a wealth of character development to work with in a short period of time compared to, well, that famous series that she's part of. And at the end is Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who plays a police officer. And here, Jeffrey delivers a stoic and empathetic performance that closes the film in a really emotional beat. In the midst of this is also a performance from Michael Raymond James, which is best described as one delivered with a resignation that hints at the desolate future that America faces as it continues to struggle with an epidemic of violence. To be clear, The Integrity of Joseph Chambers is not a film that explores in-depth America's relationship with guns or violence, but rather seeks to recontextualize and examine what the modern American man actually is. Just how is somebody who realistically should not own a gun, let alone shoot one, supposed to manage in a society that almost dictates the need to have one? It's this discussion point that Robert talks about the most in this interview, recorded ahead of the Integrity of Joseph Chambers' launch at Perth's Revelation Film Festival. Integrity screens on July 14 and 15, with tickets being available via revelationfilmfest.org. Make sure to listen to the previous discussion that I had with Robert about The Killing of Two Lovers, where he talked about being influenced by filmmaker Kelly Reichardt. You can hear that on the website thecurb.com.au. For now, here's a little bit of the trailer of The Integrity of Joseph Chambers, and then Robert will return to talk about the film.
Hey, little lady.
Oh, I'm sleeping. Please go back to the bathroom, shave it off.
Not shave it off? It's my hunting look.
Tons of guys around here hunt for their livelihood.
You're not from here, Joe.
Can I borrow your rifle?
You need ammo?
Nah, I bought some.
If you just wait till next week, I can go.
Thanks again.
I'm the mustache man. I'll catch it, I'll kill it any way I can.
This was, I could take care of my family.
My wife didn't even want me to come out here today. I'm just saying, it seems like the whole world's falling apart.
Come on, Joe. This thing's happening. Huh? He's trespassing. You're doing what's right. You did the right thing, Joe. You have to tell me what happened.
See, and I wanted to start talking about the genre or the at least the feel that you've got going here, because it bounces between comedy and drama in quite an interesting way. And I've read some pieces where people say it's a very hilarious film, and then other people say that it's a really like soul-wrenching film as well. And it's like these two things are working in harmony together. And I'm curious if you can talk about the difference between, you know, balancing a comedy as well as having that kind of seriousness in there.
Yeah, I really, comedy is so hard. I mean, it's a very difficult, I've always been really actually envious of comedy because it's such a challenging genre of cinema to take on, because you can end up with people laughing, but they're not laughing because the movie's good. You know, they're laughing because it's like so ridiculous, or maybe you've written a funny scene, but overall you haven't written a very compelling film as a whole. And I wanted to really play into the kind of idiocy of Joseph Chambers as a way to kind of, I felt to get a little bit more raw at like our existence, and men in particular. You know, we have this obligation sometimes due to society to be the people that know what's going on in a circumstance purely out of the kind of the gender roles, when we know very little. And I was actually really struck with, so Jeremy Davis was the liaison when we were shooting Killing Two Lovers. He's the guy who's working on his truck. And I mean, he lived in rural, in Kanosh, in that rural area. And we, you know, there's a gun in that film as well. And I was talking to him one time about weapons, and he was like, I don't really know much about them. And I thought like, oh, you're in this like, you know, my naive assumptions was he would know, I'm like in a town of 300, but, you know, food is an hour and a half away. I would have just assumed you would have been a part of hunting culture. I just assumed you would have like owned weapons, and he did not. And I was really kind of taken by that and those kind of expectations kind of placed upon us. So I really wanted the idiocy to play in this idea of Joseph acting as if he understood what he was doing. But I wanted like a real gun owner to be like so uncomfortable, along with the non-gun owners to be really, you know, can we collectively agree that Joe should not have a weapon? And I thought that would make the harder things that we were going to dive into, as the Coen brothers do in some of their films, the deeper things you dive into, not be like drugging people through the mud the whole movie, but maybe there would be levity kind of throughout as well.
I mean, that's the thing which I think is so fascinating, certainly as an outsider looking in, is about seeing gun culture in America and seeing people's engagement with guns and of varying kinds. And of course, in Australia, we have a very different relationship with guns and things like that. And it's, you know, it's its own complex beast. But with both Killing and Integrity here, I find it fascinating that like you're really engaging with the notion of violence, and it feels like it's continually on the precipice of happening. And it's by characters who either intentionally want it to happen or maybe accidentally want it to happen. And as again, as an outsider, America is perceived, maybe rightly, maybe wrongly, as a very violent nation. There seems to be this interrogation of that violence in your work. And I'm curious if you can say whether it's maybe trying to reconcile with the violence or the people who are often the perpetrators of the violence.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, for me, it's conflicting in a way. I mean, I grew up mainly in California in a rural community there in the Salinas Valley where, you know, friends of mine were very kind of involved in the hunting culture. I remember eating, you know, like the first jerky I ever had was deer jerky. I naively didn't know they made beef jerky until I was like significantly older, because it was the only jerky I ever had. But the majority of the community was a farming community, so it wasn't really a gun community. And then when I moved to Utah has a very high hunting culture, but also weapon owning culture, as far as people who don't hunt but also own weapons in the home. And that was kind of an interesting for me, this kind of complicated, like, how do I feel about this? You know, like, I know my children are going to be at friends' houses and there'll be weapons in the home. And so then I needed to kind of educate myself a little bit more on that and find out, you know, from people in this area, how they respond to guns. And many of them have, you know, gun closets and they're locked and, you know, they don't have ammo in the same, you know, their safety mechanisms. So I think some of the exploration for me has been wanting to be this naively kind of liberal anti-idea, then being kind of pushed into a community that I understood. Like, I've met guys that like kill elk at the beginning of the year and their family eats on that all year. I mean, it's like elk, potatoes, carrots. I could stop by any day And like, due to their financial circumstances, like that's what they're going to be eating every day. And so it's really, really kind of complicated for me. So I don't know if I'm trying to rectify anything, but explore that, like, it's very American to have an opinion on guns, either way. And in many cases have a very strong opinion one way or the other. And so it's like, I think in these films, as I've explored it, you know, with Killing, it was really like assigning the gun as a symbol of masculinity. So as David goes to it, it's like him, this energy that you're supposed to, like, you know, protect your property kind of thing come into play. There's a little bit of that in Integrity, but I thought it was an interesting kind of play where the weapon is not his. It's a borrow. So like this next echelon of masculinity is like borrowed. It's not inherent in American men to understand how to use weapons, but it is an idea of like, maybe you should at some point, because you might have to protect your family, you know?
I love that he's just not comfortable with holding it as well. There's this really awkward stance of it. And I mean, I just felt really uncomfortable at times with seeing him running through, and I'm like, something bad's going to happen to him or something else. And of course it does, but it's just that notion that you don't know how to hold it. You don't know how to actually, you know, prop yourself.
And it's a real testament to kind of Klain's performance in this film, because he understands weapons. He grew up in Alabama. There is a hunting community there. And when we were, you know, one of the first scenes that we shot at the beginning of the shoot was him loading the weapon at the truck. And I was actually very nervous that it would be too obvious that he understood a weapon, you know, that it just is the comfort, the you know, the muscle memory. And the first take we did, I mean, everyone on set was just so like, oh, like, you know, and I was like, okay, we're good. Like he's bringing exactly what we need as it relates to that discomfort. So yeah. That was very thrilling, because that was from the, you know, as a writer, you write these things with this imagination in intact, and then you hand it off to an actor, and it's like you're hoping that communication's been translated.
We'll talk about the themes a little bit more, and then we'll go into the production side of the film. But I'm curious if we can talk about the idea of the American man, the idea of the modern American man, because in both Killing and Integrity, you're really exploring different facets of masculinity that we don't really get to see, because there is not, you know, the character here of Joe is not really, like, he's not a terrible person. He's just trying to do the right thing that he feels is the thing that he needs to do as somebody pushed into it by society.
Yeah. For me, I think what's happening, this is my own opinion, obviously, but I think there's a rewriting that's occurring that we're in the middle of, which is rewriting what it is to be an American man in our country. And I think many of the men my age are really exploring that. You know, it's like it's funny because I don't know what it is, but our generation is right in the middle, I guess I would say. You know, you deal with somebody maybe 3 years older than you that's very rooted in, like, you know, the ideas of masculinity and are unapologetic or unforgiving about that and the way that they feel about it. And then you have somebody 3 years younger than you that is actually very opposed, you know, like they don't know how to use a screwdriver, which again, to me is like, oh, come on, you got it. Like, you know, and it's like being a man doesn't mean you know how to use a screwdriver. So I think we're like kind of stuck in this kind of middle area. And I think in a lot of my writing, it's exploring, I'm like, I'm in this middle and we're trying to rewrite what it is, and that the impact in which we rewrite it will actually impact our children and the way that our children. So I think a lot of, with both of these films, I'm trying to kind of like, in my own mind, like, what are we leaving behind? What are we establishing? What are age of men of this kind of age, how they're toggling it? And Integrity is very much that, you know, we're dealing with COVID, we're dealing with, you know, this apocalyptic ideas, and you're stuck with like, what is it that I do? And the reality is, if you do the research, farming is what you do. You're like, learn how to raise potatoes, you know, but that's like not as interesting as like going to a rifle range and like becoming like proficient in a weapon, you know?
But on the same hand as well, like, not everybody thinks to research, right? So not everybody sits down to go, this is what I should do. They look at what everybody else does. Maybe they watch Doomsday Preppers or something like that, and they go, I get a gun, I go and kill a deer, and that's it. Like, yeah, 1, 2, 3, done. Yeah.
100%. Yeah, the Doomsday Prepper I watched on Netflix for a lot of, in the research of the writing I was doing, and 100%. I mean, you're correct. I mean, on those, I remember Clayne and I sending emails back and forth talking about this idea, and I came across one of the episodes where the guy shoots his thumb off. You know, and I was like, oh my gosh, episode 6, the guy shoots his thumb off, you know, and you're just like, you know, then again, living in Utah where that, I mean, that would be shameful anyway. It's the opposite. It's like, let's start with, you know, how to handle the weapon and it's empty. And so, yeah, toggling kind of between those was very kind of critical for me because they're not doing the research. And they are being kind of, I mean, gun sales go up every time, either any atrocity that's involved with a weapon, sales go up. Anytime, you know, the pandemic hit, weapon sales go up. I mean, it's just like, at the end of the day, I even watched some documentaries in central Utah, just out, you know, people that are just kind of wanting to leave society and are just like going out to these middles of nowhere. And many of them, maybe a little, were initially being kind of anti or apprehensive about guns, and then being like, oh, I'm a woman sleeping in, you know, in a van out in the middle of nowhere. It's actually a requirement that I have one there. Therefore I need to learn how to use it. But they've learned that week and a half into already having moved there. So it's like, it's a local person who's like, hey, okay, let's teach you how to use a weapon as a result of the fact that you're going to live out here. So same thing. Not a lot of research happening, just reactionary, which I think we're all dealing with right now.
I want to talk about Clayne, the opening with Clayne shaving and creating this magnificent mustache, which I think is really quite a impressive mustache. And he, you know, there's this distinction almost between killing and here where he looks so different between the characters. And I'm curious if you can talk about how, you know, this character here, he's almost dressing up in a kind of masculinity that he thinks people should look like. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I very much wanted this to be a performance. You know, this is not who Joseph is, like, believing he has to take on the identity of a character. And so the outfit and the way in which he looks, which, you know, we got a great kick out of, because it's like, you look like a J. Crew model of what a hunter should look like, but not actually what a real hunter would even kind of look like. And because we wanted to really, once he enters kind of the woods and he falls asleep, we're like, we're moving into the surrealist aspect, and we're really toggling this, like, what's going on in his mind versus what's happening in reality. And so, yeah, we thought it really actually kind of important that, you know, we open as he's like obsessively sculpting this mustache. Like, that's, you know, if you can imagine in his head, he's like, I'm going to get up in the morning because he wants it fresh. You know, he wants it to look, well, he could have shaved it the night before, but it's like, no, everything's got to, you know, it's got to fit how clean and pristine the, you know, the jacket's going to be and the coat underneath. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And we, of course, wanted the audience to know, like, you're going to be able to laugh in this movie, and we want you to know it's actually okay to laugh in the film.
Let's talk about the sound design as well, if we can, because it is really quite impressive and immaculate. But I'm curious if you can talk about how you chose the layers of sounds, specifically also talking about the presence of sports sounds too. I imagine that's baseball sounds. If you can talk about that as well, would be great.
Yeah, I was re-teaming with Peter Albrechtsen, who we've worked together for quite a few films now. And then we added Will Fritsch, who is a composer I've worked with, and Peter has actually worked with a lot. And as we started to begin to discuss the sounds, we were really discussing, like, we're going to toggle between, you know, surrealism, and we're going to move into surrealism in a way that's very different. With Killing of Two Lovers, it was really important that we understood the anxiety and the angst that David was feeling the longer he was away from his kids. And it was very like this repeating sound that began to build and build and build. And here we were like, no, he's like, after he wakes up from being in the deer stand, we are Alice in the Looking Glass. We've gone through into, you know, if the movie ended with him waking back up and he's just in the deer stand, we were like, that could be a satisfactory ending as well, you know? And so with that, we began to really like introduce some of the sounds that we would continue to build kind of as, so when we get to the baseball sequence, he's fully in this fantasy world with himself, where he's this, you know, this grandiose, very great baseball player winning the World Series. We did the same thing as it relates to the world sounds. What Peter did is he went and he got I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, but he's been recording forests for like, 10, 20 years. And so we started in the Alabama forest, knowing that we would eventually end in not a real forest, that we'd have birds from other parts of the country. We'd have animals for the other, a tree creaking from other parts of the country. So he's fully no longer in this place that he's familiar with. And that began to be really important. And then even with Will Fritch, we started like, you hear these birds and eventually they're not birds anymore. They're violins that are mimicking the bird sounds, and the sounds of the creaking forest are no longer actual trees, but the sound of like instruments that Will's built and created for the movie. For me, that's really exciting, because I think sound is like an equal partner with performance and cinematography. And so I try and grab it as much time and as much talent as I can from Peter and Will.
It just immerses you into the world and his mind so completely. It is a vital part. And I think that, you know, often it might be, for some filmmakers, it might be something that is not immediately the forefront of their mind, because they're thinking about the things that are in front of them, you know, the visuals, the performance and things like that. But layering that sound on really just amplifies the narrative so well. But then on the flip side, we've got these long tracking shots and these beautiful shots, which just really quite immerse you in the story as well. But I'm curious if you can talk about those shots, but then also when you decide to cut, at what point do you decide to say, all right, this is enough, we've spent a long enough time with Joe in this particular moment?
Yeah, it's actually scary and pretty challenging working on these films with the production time that we have. I feel like when I'm listening to podcasts, I get so envious of the filmmakers being like, oh, we took 3 days to shoot the scene. And I'm like, man, I wish I had 3 hours to shoot the scene. It would be exciting to get that time and to explore. And since we don't, it requires so much calculation. It's like thinking about the beginning, middle, and end of a scene existing in one kind of take. And I think a lot about that as it relates to the performance. So to give you an example, it's like when Joe is walking with the rifle and he's kind of using it to kind of clear the corn stalks. And it's like there are multiple elements that are happening. One, again, anyone who is an avid hunter is like, you're making so much noise. Like a squirrel wouldn't be within a mile of you because you're being so careless. But then it's like, so we have that layer that's happening. And then it's the layer of the scene. It's like this, the anxiety for the audience has to build as it relates to how careless he's being with this weapon. And then once it's like too much, you know, and he put, you know, specifically he's cleaning the gun out as he's blowing in to get the dirt away. And you're like, this guy's going to, you know, blow his head off. Then I'm like, okay, now we're almost following the 3-act structure in the beginning, you know, the climax. And then we're like the resolution, he doesn't die. We have to be out of that scene now, because otherwise we're kind of dragging it on farther. So it was very tricky. And then Yvette Amirian's a great editor. And so we really kind of explored, like, it was kind of twofold. It's like the force itself is happening, but then how it's also the boredom of like, what will we need to then later justify how careless he is as it relates to the actions that occur. And that has to also happen via time. So it's really tricky, because sometimes you watch films and you're like, let me tell you what's going to happen and justify it real quick through a series of quick cuts, so that when we get to here, you're like, oh yeah, because they told me, you know, within the first 5 minutes, hey, this is going to happen. And I don't necessarily like to do that. I like to do it. I try and do it more in the context of time, so that people feel that, like, oh my gosh, like, why doesn't he just go home? You know, and it's, And it's like, you're feeling what he's feeling because I want you to feel that, because later, because of his actions, I want you also to feel what he's feeling when he's making these decisions. I don't want you to be the observer of those decisions. I want you to feel the same anxiety. And you're like, no, come on. And so it's really tricky and scary, because it's like, if you push it too far, you can lose some people. You don't push it enough, you've not accomplished what you're hoping to get at.
It's that really difficult balance. I took my hat off to you, because there is so long that we spend with just him by himself. And I thought, you know, I really enjoyed it, but I found it's an audacious choice to be able to go, all right, we're just going to sit with him just mucking around and not being a very good hunter at all. You know, he's...
Yeah, I'll openly admit it's scary as a filmmaker, because somebody can walk up to you and be like, that was too long. Like, you're ridiculous. And the answer's like, you're not wrong, you know, but it's like, but to push back, it's like, but you're not wrong for you. But I know from the filmmaking context and watching, I would defend my own self in the watching slow cinema and experiencing some filmmakers that are like, all right, I'm more important than you. Therefore, I'm going to challenge you to sit here, you know. I remember watching Enter the Void and finishing that movie and being like, I sat through it. There you go, Gasper. I sat, you know, and they didn't, it was the uncut, the unremoved reel, you know, and I was like, I sat through the whole 3.5 hours. And it was like, I knew he was testing that. I try and like toggle right between the middle. What feels necessary for the story, but isn't self-indulgent. And I felt confident with Klain as an actor as well, that it's like, he is somebody that like is very smart about what's happening within the frame and the use of that time within the frame, so that we're not, he's never just like, hey, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to look off, you know, into the distance and nothing's happening. Like, something will be happening if the camera is on him.
I think that's it. It is that engaging nature of Klain as an actor. And of course, your working relationship with him is so strong and great. I'm excited to see where you both go from here. But you've been bouncing between features and documentaries as well. And I'm curious if you can talk about that creative balance between, you know, writing and directing and then going and making, you know, shorts, documentaries and things like that. Is that really important for you as a filmmaker to have that kind of reprieve in between styles?
Yeah, I'm finding it, to be honest, more and more important as I am getting these resources to make films with feature films with a little more access, because it keeps me actually very grounded in the context of like the world that I'm wanting to kind of discuss, which is the world that I grew up in. And it's not like I don't want to pretend like I'm doing so well financially that I don't know that world anymore. I know it very well. But it's, say, for example, what I've been spending time with recently, this documentary that I'm working on. So I spent the last week in California in the Salinas Valley, where I grew up, with a farmer who's growing organic strawberries, and started from migrating from Mexico, came all the way, had a restaurant in Los Angeles in 2007. It crashed. He lost everything, started working in the field, slowly built up. Now he has a 200-acre farm. And it's like dealing with real organics. And then 2 weeks prior to that, being on an organic farm that was ran by Driscoll, which is the largest, you know, producer that produces, you know, so many of the strawberries, and seeing like, what are the ethics between I'm talking to the actual owner who pays the employees, and I'm talking to a corporate farm and the way that they work with their employees. And that grounds me in like, this is complicated. You know, it's like, it's not as black and white as I want it to be. It's more, you know, the Driscoll Farms paid people $2.30 a box. They could end up making almost $8,000 a week if they were fast, because they're paid by the box.
Right.
The other farm paid by the hour. People could work slower, but then their pay was like controlled by the amount of hours they worked, not by their productivity. And I was like, oh man, this is complicated. There's not a like one answer I can just hold myself to and be like, this is the right ethical answer. And I long-windedly say that to mean, I like to live in these grays. And the only way to really live in the grays is live around the people that have to function within these gray areas in their day-to-day life. So I feel like it always kind of helps when I sit down and writing, I'm like, am I being honest to the people I'm, you know, putting myself in circles with, so that I don't, my hope is never to, you know, to never really misrepresent the, this world that's my, you know, that I grew up in, but it's different. You know, I'm not a hunter. So yeah. I'm like, how do I make sure that, you know, I'm writing this with Joseph being this kind of idiot character, but not mocking like hunting culture. I'm mocking like someone who didn't spend the time researching hunting culture, all the while like discussing this kind of dialogue of weapons or guns in, you know, in America.
So do you have somebody who, when you write a script or you have an idea, that you bounce it off before you even start rolling?
Normally I try and talk to people that kind of live in that world. Like with Integrity, I went down and I met with a sheriff in a small town for about an hour and a half and kind of interviewed him about like what would occur in this scenario. And then I, you know, spent some time with a couple of people. One of them's a painter who I really, really admire, who he's the bow hunter that, you know, will kill a deer at the beginning of the year and he'll eat that deer throughout the year, to try and get at like I'm like, how can I, you know, bounce these ideas, suggest things, and they'll normally inform me of like, no, that's not correct, or that's reaching. The project that I'm working on right now, interestingly enough, is about, it's called I Love You Now and Forever, and it's about a couple who gets stuck in a situation that revolves somewhat around the healthcare industry, and my neighbor down the two, three doors down works in it. So I'm asking him, you know, how can I explore the complicated aspect of healthcare in the United States without just pointing a finger at one person, you know, instead be like, dude, what are we doing? Like if the film is successful, the question shouldn't be like someone's evil. It should be like, what's going on? What are we doing, guys? Can we talk about it?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. It sounds like you're exploring some interesting things. And that's what I enjoy about your films. You always pick something up and you look at it in such a fascinating manner that it makes the viewer reconsider the world that they're looking at or that they live in. It's really brilliant. Thank you. So thank you.
Yeah, that's my hope. I mean, cinema, I love it. I mean, I sit and I watch films and I sit and admire, you know, the work, and I feel lucky to be able to be kind of a contributor to that art form. And it's just exciting.
Yeah. As a last question, is there anything that's kind of stuck in your mind from, you know, maybe lesser known films or filmmakers that you've seen recently that has really resonated with you?
Yeah, I just sent it to a friend of mine. It's called Falcon Lake. Have you seen
this movie? I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. No.
Watch it. Yeah, I would highly recommend it. It was very, for me, I was like so glad I saw it because it toggles fantasy in a way, like the way it ties up. I was like, I mean, it's the first 40 minutes, you're like, I've seen this movie. It's a coming of age film, you know, on a family vacation. I got you. And then the way it progresses, I was like, I mean, I almost oddly stood up and clapped in my office. I was so taken by it. And I was like, they dealt with fantasy, or Rodrigo, who I collaborate with a lot, calls it fantastical realism. Mm-hmm. In a really kind of very, very cool way. So yeah, I try and watch kind of, you watch the people that you should admire and like look up to. And then I try and watch the people that are like exploring in my world as well to find inspiration.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely check it out. Yeah. Thank you, Robert, for your time. I appreciate it so much. I look forward to chatting with you again in 2 years' time when I get to see this documentary.
That'd be great.
Yeah, awesome. No worries.
All right.
Thanks, mate.
We'll see
Have a good night. Cheers.
You too.